The Revolutionary Lumpen Proletariat. The drug-taking, apathetic young black people we bemoan today are the result of our failure to protect and cherish the Black Panthers during the 60s. Sonia Sanchez. It is time to meet LA's Viet Cong. Although the study of barrio gangs is a vast cottage industry dating back to Emery Bogardus's 1926 monograph, inspired by the Chicago School, The City Boy and His Problems, almost nothing has been written about the history of South Central LA's sociologically distinct gang culture. The earliest repeated references to a gang problem in the black community press, moreover, deal with gangs of white youth who terrorized black residents along the frontiers of the southward expanding Central Avenue ghetto. See Chapter 3. Indeed, from these newspaper accounts and the recollections of old-timers, it seems probable that the first generation of black street gangs emerged as a defensive response to white violence in the schools and streets during the late 1940s. The Eagle, for example, records racial gang wars at Manual Arts High School in 1946, Canoga Park High in the Valley in 1947, and John Adams High in 1949, while blacks at Fremont High were continuously assaulted throughout 1946 and 1947. Possibly as a result of their origin in these school integration transition battles, black gangs, until the 1970s, tended to be predominantly defined by school-based turfs rather than by the microscopically drawn neighborhood territorialities of Chicano gangs. Aside from defending black teenagers from racist attacks, which continued through the 1950s under the aegis of such white gangs as the Spook Hunters, the early South Central gangs, the Businessmen, Slossons, Gladiators, Farmers, Parks, Outlaws, Watts, Boot Hill, Rebel Rousers, Roman Twenties, and so forth, were also the architects of social space in new and usually hostile settings. As tens of thousands of 1940s and 1950s black immigrants crammed into the overcrowded, absentee landlord-dominated neighborhoods of the ghetto's east side, lowrider gangs offered cool worlds of urban socialization for poor young newcomers from rural Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Meanwhile, on the other side of Main Street, more affluent black youngsters from the West Side bungalow belt created a status-oriented simulacrum of the ubiquitous white car club subculture of Los Angeles in the 1950s. As J.K. Obatala would recall, besides the territorial factor, there was an element of class warfare in the 1950s. Members of gangs such as the Flips and the Slossons were Westsiders whose families usually had a little more money and who considered themselves more socially sophisticated than their East Side counterparts. The Eastsiders, in turn, looked upon their rivals to the West as snobs and sometimes deliberately ventured into their sphere of influence to break up parties or other social events. While rumbling, usually non-lethally, along this east-west socioeconomic divide, or sometimes simply an extension of intramural athletic rivalries, the black gangs of the 1950s also had to confront the implacable, often lethal racism of Chief Parker's LAPD. In the days when the young Daryl Gates was driver to the great chief, the policing of the ghetto was becoming simultaneously less corrupt but more militarized and brutal. Under previous police chiefs, for example, Central Avenue's boisterous interracial night scene had simply been shaken down for tribute. Under Parker, a puritanical crusader against race mixing, nightclubs and juke joints were raided and shuttered. In 1954, John Dolphin, owner of Los Angeles's premier R&B record store near the corner of Vernon and Central, organized a protest of 150 black business people against an ongoing campaign of intimidation and terror, directed at interracial trade. According to Dolphin, Newton Division Police had gone so far as to blockade his store, turning away all white customers and warning them that it was too dangerous to hang around black neighborhoods. After smashing interracial vice on Central Avenue, Chief Parker launched his own all-out war on narcotics in South Central and East LA, alleging that heroin and marijuana were being exported to white neighborhoods. He charged in the press that the communists furthered the heroin and marijuana trade because drug use sped the moral degeneration of America. Prefiguring Gates's call years later for the invasion of Colombia, Parker demanded the closing of the Mexican border, while his principal newspaper supporter, the Herald Express, called for the execution of drug dealers. Chief Parker also did his bit to support the Times' crusade against socialistic public housing, see Chapter 2, by using phony crime statistics to paint lurid images of jungle life in the projects, a political manipulation of police data which some critics feel is continued through the present. Like his protege successors, Chief Parker invoked racialized crime scares to justify his tireless accumulation of power. As one of his retiring subordinates observed in 1981, Parker constantly and self-servingly projected the specter of a vast criminal reservoir in South Central LA, all blacks as bad guys, held in check by an outnumbered but heroically staunch blue line. Accordingly, any diminution of the police budget or questioning of Parker's authority would weaken the dike and release a black crime deluge on peaceful white neighborhoods. Consider, for example, the chief's extraordinary testimony before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights in early 1960. A belligerent Parker characterized the LAPD as the real embattled minority and argued that the tensions between LA's minority communities and the cops had simply to do with the fact that blacks and Latinos were statistically many times more likely than whites to commit crimes. Indeed, Parker assured the commission that the established, read white, community thinks cops aren't hard enough on black vice. Parker sparked a 500-strong protest rally in East Los Angeles when he went on to offer his insight into the high crime rate in the barrios, explaining that the people who lived there were only one step removed from the wild tribes of Mexico. Since wild tribes and gang perils were its golden geese, it is not surprising that Parker's LAPD looked upon the rehabilitation of gang youth in much the same way as the arms industry regarded peacemongering or disarmament treaties. Vehemently opposed to the extension of constitutional rights to juveniles and loathing social workers, Chief Parker, a strict Victorian, launched a concerted attack on the group guidance unit of the probation department, a small program that had emerged out of the so-called Zoot Suit riots of 1943. The original sin of group guidance, in the chief's opinion, was that they gave status to gang activity by treating gang members as socially transformable individuals. Like the contemporary rhetoric of the hammer or blacklash, the LAPD in the 1950s and early 1960s dichotomized youth offenders into two groups. On one hand were mere delinquents, mainly white youth, susceptible to the shock treatment of juvenile hall. On the other hand were juvenile criminals, mainly black and Chicano, miniature versions of J. Edgar Hoover's mad dogs, destined to spend their lives within the state prison system. Essential to the LAPD worldview was the assertion that ghetto gang youth were composed of the latter, a residuum of hardcore, unrehabilitable criminality. Moreover, as black nationalist groups like the Muslims began to appear in the ghetto in the late 1950s, Parker, like Hoover, began to see the gang problem and the militant threat as forming a single overarching structure of black menace. The LAPD's own abuses, in fact, were a self-fulfilling prophecy, radicalizing gang subculture in South Central. After the LAPD's unprovoked attack on a Nation of Islam mosque in April 1962, which left one Muslim killed and six wounded, a community uprising against Parker's army of occupation became envisioned as justified and virtually inevitable. Thus, in May 1964, Howard Jewell memoed his boss, California Attorney General Stanley Mosk, that soon the long hot summer will be upon us. The evidence from L.A. is ominous. Jewell blamed Chief Parker for inciting racial polarization and predicted widespread violence. At the same time, the black version of the Southern California dream, which had lured hundreds of thousands of hopeful immigrants from the Southwest, was collapsing. Excluded from lucrative construction and aerospace jobs, black youth experienced the 1959 through 65 period, the white kids' endless summer, as a winter of discontent. The absolute income gap between black and white Angelenos dramatically widened. Median incomes in South Central LA declined by almost a tenth, and black unemployment skyrocketed from 12% to 20%, 30% in Watts. Despite deceptive palm-lined streets and cute bungalow exteriors, the housing stock of South Central was dilapidated, the largest blighted area of any U.S. city, according to the Regional Planning Commission. but every attempt by civil rights groups to expand job or housing opportunities for blacks was countered by fierce white resistance, culminating in the 75% white vote in 1964, Proposition 14, to repeal the Rumford Fair Housing Act. Yet unlike today's social polarization, this was also the heroic age of the civil rights movement, of epic debates about strategies of liberation. South Central gang youth, coming under the influence of the Muslims and the long-distance charisma of Malcolm X, began to reflect the generational awakening of black power. As Obatala describes the new breed of the 1960s, their perceptions were changing. Those who formerly had seen things in terms of East and West were now beginning to see many of the same things in black and white. As the gangs began to become politicized, they became alfresco churches whose ministers brought the gospel of black power out into the streets. Veteran civil rights activists can recall one memorable instance during a protest at a local whites-only drive-in restaurant when the timely arrival of black gang members saved them from a mauling by white hot rodders. The gang was the legendary Slossons, based in the Fremont High area, and they became a crucial social base for the rise of the local black liberation movement. The turning point, of course, was the Festival of the Oppressed in August 1965, that the black community called a rebellion, and the white media, a riot. Although the riot commission, headed by old guard Republicans John McCone and Asa Call, supported Chief Parker's so-called riffraff theory, that the August events were the work of a small criminal minority, subsequent research, using the McCone Commission's own data, proved that up to 75,000 people took part in the uprising, mostly from the stolid black working class. For gang members, it was the last great rumble, as formerly hostile groups forgot old grudges and cheered each other on against the hated LAPD and the National Guard. Connaught cites examples of old enemies like the Slossons and the Gladiators from the 54th Street area, flashing smiles and high signs as they broke through Parker's invincible blue line. This ecumenical movement of the streets and hoods lasted for 3 or 4 years. Community workers and even the LAPD themselves were astonished by the virtual cessation of gang hostilities as the gang leadership joined the revolution. Two leading Slossons, apprentice Bunchy Carter, a famous warlord, and John Huggins, became the local organizers of the Black Panther Party, while a third, Brother Crook, a.k.a. Ron Wilkins, created the Community Alert Patrol to monitor police abuse. Meanwhile, an old Watts gang hangout near Jordan Downs, the parking lot, became a recruiting center for the Sons of Watts, who organized and guarded the annual Watts Festival. It is not really surprising, therefore, that in the late 1960s, the do-ragged, hardcore street brothers and sisters, who for an extraordinary week in 1965 had actually driven the police out of the ghetto, were visualized by black power theorists as the strategic reserve of black liberation, if not its vanguard. A similar fantasy of a warriors-like unification of the gangs was popular amongst sections of the Chicano left. There was a potent moment in this period, around 1968-9, when the Panthers, their following soaring in the streets and high schools, looked as if they might become the ultimate revolutionary gang. Teenagers, who today flock to hear Eazy-E rap, "It ain't about color, it's about the color of money, I love that green," then filled the sports arena to listen to Stokely Carmichael, H. Rap Brown, Bobby Seale, and James Foreman adumbrate the unity program of SNCC and the Panthers. The Black Congress and the People's Tribunal convened to try the LAPD for the murder of Gregory Clark were other expressions of the same aspiration for unity and militancy. But the combined efforts of the FBI's notorious COINTELPRO program and the LAPD's Public Disorder Intelligence Division, a super red squad that, until 1982, maintained surveillance on every suspicious group from the Panthers to the National Council of Churches, were concentrated upon destroying Los Angeles's black power vanguards. The February 1969 murders of Panther leaders Carter and Huggins on the UCLA campus by members of a rival nationalist group, which Panther veterans still insist was actually police-instigated, was followed a year later by the debut of LAPD's SWAT team in a day-long siege of the Panthers' South Central headquarters. Although a general massacre of the Panther cadre was narrowly averted by an angry community outpouring into the streets, the party was effectively destroyed. As even the Times recognized, The decimation of the Panthers led directly to a recrudescence of gangs in the early 1970s. Crippin, the most extraordinary new gang phenomenon, was a bastard offspring of the Panthers' former charisma, filling the void left by the LAPD SWAT teams. There are various legends about the original Crips, but they agree on certain particulars. As Donald Bakir, a teacher at Manual Arts High, explains in his self-published novel about the Crips, the first set was incubated in the social wasteland created by the clearances for the Century Freeway, a traumatic removal of housing and destruction of neighborhood ties that was the equivalent of a natural disaster. His protagonist, a second-generation Crip, boasts to his homeboys, "My daddy was a member of the original 107 Hoover Crip Gang, the original Crips in Los Angeles, OG, original gangster, to the max." Secondly, as journalist Bob Baker has determined, the real OG number one of the 107 Hoovers, who split away from an older gang called the Avenues, was a young man powerfully influenced by the Panthers in their late 60s heyday. He was Raymond Washington, a Fremont High School student who had been too young to be a Black Panther, but had soaked up some of the Panther rhetoric about community control of neighborhoods. After Washington was kicked out of Fremont, he wound up at Washington High, and something began to gel in the neighborhood where he lived around 107th and Hoover Streets. Although it is usually surmised that the name Crip is derived from the 107 Hoover's crippled style of walking, Bakir was told by one OG that it originally stood for Continuous Revolution in Progress. However apocryphal this translation may be, it best describes the phenomenal spread of Crip sets across the ghetto between 1970 and 1972. A 1972 gang map, released by the LAPD's 77th Street Division, shows a quilt work of blue-ragged Crips, both east side and west side, as well as miscellany of other gangs, some descended from the pre-Watts generation. Under incessant Crip pressure, these independent gangs, the Brims, Bounty Hunters, Denver Lanes, Athens Park Gang, the Bishops, and especially the powerful Pyrus, federated as the red-handkerchiefed Bloods. Particularly strong in Black communities peripheral to the South Central Core, like Compton, Pacoima, Pasadena, and Pomona, the Bloods have been primarily a defensive reaction formation to the aggressive emergence of the Crips. It needs to be emphasized that this was not merely a gang revival, but a radical permutation of Black gang culture. The Crips, however, perversely, inherited the Panther aura of fearlessness and transmitted the ideology of armed vanguardism, shorn of its program. In some instances, Crip insignia continued to denote Black power, as during the Monrovia riots in 1972, or the LA school busing crisis of 1977 through 9. But too often, Crippin came to represent an escalation of intra-ghetto violence to Clockwork Orange levels, murder as a status symbol, and so on, that was unknown in the days of the Slossons and anathema to everything that the Panthers had stood for. Moreover, the Crips blended a penchant for ultra-violence with an overweening ambition to dominate the entire ghetto. Although, as Bakir subtly sketches in his novel, East Side versus West Side tensions persist, the Crips, as the Panthers before them, attempted to hegemonize an entire generation. In this regard, they achieved, like the contemporary Black Peastone Nation in Chicago, a managerial revolution in gang organization. If they began as a teenage substitute for the fallen Panthers, they evolved through the 1970s into a hybrid of teen cult and proto-mafia. At a time when economic opportunity was draining away from South Central Los Angeles, the Crips were becoming the power resource of last resort for thousands of abandoned youth. Expendable youth. Gangs are never going to die out. Y'all gonna get us jobs? 16-year-old Grape Street Crip. What would the Crips in Blood say about the carnage, if they could talk? It is, of course, a tactical absolute of anti-terrorism, whether practiced in Belfast, Jerusalem, or Los Angeles, to deny terrorism a public voice. Although terrorism is always portrayed precisely as inarticulate malevolence, authorities expend enormous energy to protect us from its ravings, even at the cost of censorship and restriction of free speech. Thus, the LAPD has vehemently and usually successfully opposed attempts by social workers and community organizers to allow gang members to tell their side of the story. A major exception was in December 1972, just as Crip mania was first sweeping Southside schools in an epidemic of gang shootings and street fights. The Human Relations Conference, against the advice of the police, gave a platform to 60 black gang leaders to present their grievances. To the astonishment of officials present, the Mad Dogs outlined an eloquent and coherent set of demands: jobs, housing, better schools, recreation facilities, and community control of local institutions. It was a bravura demonstration that gang youth, however trapped in their own delusionary spirals of vendetta and self-destruction, clearly understood that they were the children of deferred dreams and defeated equality. Moreover, as hardcore black and Chicano gang leaders have always affirmed, in the handful of other instances over the last 18 years when they have been allowed to speak, decent jobs are the price for negotiating a humane end to drug dealing and gang violence. So, what has happened to the jobs? It is necessary to recall that the revolutionary rhetoric of the 1960s was sustained by the real promise of reformism. While the Panthers were mesmerizing the campuses, civil rights politics gained new momentum with the rise of the Bradley Coalition of blacks, Jews, and liberals. Moreover, in the superheated summit of the Vietnam boom, young black men at last began to find their way, in some substantial number, into factory and transportation jobs, while black women thronged into the lower levels of the pink-collar workforce. And for teenagers and the younger unemployed, the federal government supplied a seasonal quota of temporary weed-pulling jobs and bogus training schemes to cool out the streets during the long hot summers. But the illusion of economic progress was short-lived. By 1985, the 10th anniversary of the Watts Rebellion, and year two of the Bradley era, a special report by the Times found that the black ghetto is not a viable community. It is slowly dying. In the face of double-digit unemployment, 1975 was a depression year for Southland blacks, overcrowded schools, high prices, and deteriorating housing, the fighting mood of the 1960s has been replaced by a sick apathy or angry frustration. With rebellion deterred by the paramilitarization of the police and the destruction of the community's radical fringe, Times writer John Kendall described despair recycled as gang violence and black-on-black crime. Seen from a perspective 15 years further on, it is clear that the Times and other contemporary observers did not fully appreciate the complexity of what was happening in South Central Los Angeles. Although the image of overall community demoralization was accurate enough, a sizable minority was actually experiencing moderate upward mobility, while the condition of the majority was steadily worsening. In simplified terms, Los Angeles's black community became more internally polarized as public sector craft workers, clericals, and professionals successfully entrenched themselves within city, county, and federal bureaucracies, while the semi-skilled working class in the private sector was decimated by the dual impact of job suburbanization and economic internationalization. Paradoxically, it may be equally true that black political leadership in Los Angeles County has sponsored significant economic advance and contributed to the community's benign neglect at the same time. Critics who accuse the Bradley administration of killing South Central LA usually ignore its achievements in integrating the public workforce. It has been a dynamic black public sector job base, together with smaller-scale black professional advances in the aerospace, financial, and entertainment industries, that is responsible for the prosperity visible on the black New West Side, the nouveau riche hilltops of Ladera Heights and Baldwin Hills, and the tidy tractlands of suburban Inglewood and Carson. At the same time, community economic development has been a total failure. As we have seen, the Bradley administration chose to accommodate the redevelopment agenda of the Central City Association, not the NAACP or the Mexican American Political Association. Working-class blacks in the flatlands, where nearly 40% of families live below the poverty line, have faced relentless economic decline. While city resources, to the tune of $2 billion, have been absorbed in financing the corporate renaissance of downtown, South Central LA has been markedly disadvantaged, even in receipt of anti-poverty assistance, coming in far behind West Los Angeles and the Valley in access to vital human services and job training funds. Black small businesses have withered for lack of credit or attention from the city, leaving behind only liquor stores and churches. Most tragically, the unionized branch plant economy toward which working-class blacks and Chicanos have always looked for decent jobs collapsed. As the Los Angeles economy in the 1970s was unplugged from the American industrial heartland and rewired to East Asia, non-Anglo workers have borne the brunt of adaptation and sacrifice. The 1978 through 82 wave of factory closings in the wake of Japanese import penetration and recession, which shuttered 10 of the 12 largest non-aerospace plants in Southern California and displaced 75,000 blue-collar workers, erased the ephemeral gains won by blue-collar blacks between 1965 and 1975. Where local warehouses and factories did not succumb to Asian competition, they fled instead to new industrial parks in the South Bay, Northern Orange County, or the Inland Empire. 321 firms since 1971. An investigating committee of the California legislature in 1982 confirmed the resulting economic destruction in South Central neighborhoods, unemployment rising by nearly 50% since the early 1970s, while community purchasing power fell by a third. If Eastside manufacturing employment made a spectacular recovery in the 1980s, it offered little opportunity for blacks, as the new industry overwhelmingly consisted of minimum-wage sweatshops, super-exploiting immigrant Latino labor in the production of furniture or non-durables like clothes and toys. Borrowing the terminology of Alan Lipitz, we might say that a bloody Taylorism now operates within the ruined shell of Fordism. This extinction of industrial job opportunities has had profound gender as well as socioeconomic ramifications for the black labor force. Young black women have been partially able to compensate for community deindustrialization by shifting into lower-level information processing jobs. Young black working-class men, on the other hand, have seen their labor market options, apart from military service, virtually collapse as the factory and truck driving jobs that gave their fathers and older brothers a modicum of dignity have either been replaced by imports or relocated to white areas far out on the galactic spiral arms of the LA megalopolis, 50 to 80 miles away in San Bernardino or Riverside counties. Equally, young blacks have been largely excluded from the boom in suburban service employment. As we saw in Chapter 3, it is a stunning fact, emblematic of institutional racism on a far more rampant scale than usually admitted these days, that most of California's 1980s job and residential growth poles, Southern Orange County, Eastern Ventura County, Northern San Diego County, Contra Costa County, and so on, have black populations of 1% or less. At the same time, young blacks willing to compete for more centrally located menial service jobs find themselves in a losing competition with new immigrants, not least because of clear employer opinions about labor docility. As a result, unemployment amongst black youth in Los Angeles County, despite unbroken regional growth and a new explosion of conspicuous consumption, remain at a staggering 45% through the late 1980s. A 1985 survey of public housing projects in the ghetto discovered that there were only 120 employed breadwinners out of 1,060 households in Nickerson Gardens, 70 out of 400 at Pueblo del Rio, and 100 out of 700 at Jordan Downs. The scale of pent-up demand for decent manual employment was also vividly demonstrated a few years ago when 50,000 predominantly black and Chicano youth lined up for miles to apply for a few openings on the unionized longshore in San Pedro. This deterioration in the labor market position of young black men is a major reason why the counter-economy of drug dealing and youth crime is burgeoned. But it is not the whole story. Correlated to the economic peripheralization of working-class blacks has been the dramatic juvenation of poverty amongst all inner-city ethnic groups. Statewide, the percentage of children in poverty has doubled from 11% to 23% over the last generation. In Los Angeles County during the 1980s, a chilling 40% of children either lived below or hovered just above the official poverty line. The poorest areas in the county, moreover, are invariably the youngest, of 66 census tracts in 1980 with median family incomes under $10,000, over 70% had a median age of only 20 to 24 years, the rest 25 to 29. As the political muscle of affluent homeowners continues to ensure residential segregation and the redistribution of tax resources upwards, inner-city youth have been the victims of a conscious policy of social disinvestment. The tacit expendability of black and brown youth in the City of Angels can be directly measured by the steady drainage of resources, with minimum outcry from elected officials, from the programs that serve the most urgent needs. Most telling, perhaps, have been the successive attacks on youth employment schemes, beginning with the Nixon administration's decision, echoed by then-Governor Reagan, to roll back Great Society community activism and redirect urban aid from the cities to the suburbs. The dismantling of the Neighborhood Youth Corps, followed under Reagan by the termination of the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, CETA, and the evisceration of the Jobs Corps, were the landmarks in this retreat from the inner city. In Los Angeles, the major current source of public youth employment is the Los Angeles Summer Job Program, a typical fire insurance scheme that is a pale shadow of its abolished federal predecessors. Ironically, at the very moment in 1987-8, when the Klieg-light scrutiny of Hollywood and all the media was focused on illicit youth employment, the summer job program was cut back by the city council. Job alternatives for gang members have been almost non-existent, despite widespread recognition that jobs are more potent deterrents to youth crime than step laws or long penitentiary sentences. As Charles Norman, the veteran director of Youth Gang Services, observed in 1981, you could pull 80% of gang members, 17 years old or younger, out of gangs if you had jobs, job training, and social alternatives. State Senate President Pro Tem David Roberti, the top Democrat from Hollywood, acknowledged 8 years later that Proposition 13 had ripped inner-city neighborhoods apart, preventing Norman's strategic expenditures on gang prevention. Finally, as the LAPD's budget crept above $400 million in 1988, the city council begrudgingly approved a $500,000 pilot program to create 100 jobs for high-risk youth. In the vast escalation of hostilities since the mid-1980s, this pathetic program is the only carrot that the city has actually offered to its estimated 50,000 gang youth. The school system, meanwhile, has been traveling backwards at high speed. At the state level, California's celebrated educational system has been in steep decline, with per capita student expenditure falling from 9th to 33rd place, or merely a third of the per capita level of New York. The Los Angeles Unified School District, the nation's second largest, serving 600,000 students, has classrooms more crowded than Mississippi's, at a soaring dropout rate of 30 to 50% in its inner-city high schools. The term unified is a misnomer, as for many years the district has operated de facto separate systems for blacks, Latinos, and whites. One result is that black males from South Central are now three times more likely to end up in prison than at the University of California. As the NAACP is charged in a major lawsuit, segregation remains rampant and school quality is directly reflective of the socioeconomic levels of neighborhoods. Moreover, as NAACP attorney Joseph Duff has explained, racial isolation in schools has been ramified by historic rental discrimination against families with children. Certain areas of the city with high-density, low-cost apartments and older, large, single-family homes have become veritable children's ghettos. Public schools have been burdened by the concentration of school-age children in these family areas. The racial isolation has assumed an overlay of class isolation. Ill-served by an overburdened and separate but unequal school system, low-income youth fare even worse after school. In Los Angeles County, there are an estimated 250,000 to 350,000 latchkey kids between the ages of 5 and 14 who have no adult supervision between the final school bell and their parents' return from work. In the meantime, the Bradley administration, applying triage to city programs in the wake of fiscal austerity, has virtually abandoned public recreation. In 1987, it allocated a paltry $30,000 in recreational equipment for 150 centers serving hundreds of thousands of poor children. It has also adopted the principle of apportioning its reduced park budget through a formula based on park size, while encouraging parks to operate as businesses based on user fees. Since the wealthy areas of the city have disproportionate shares of park area and fee-generating facilities, this has entailed a regressive redistribution of park resources. The result is recreational apartheid and a calamitous deterioration of public space in the inner city as parks become increasingly run down, unsupervised, and dangerous. There has been desultory political mobilization against the hollowing out of the economic and social infrastructures of South Central or the pauperization of a generation of inner city youth. Of the leadership generation of the Watts Rebellion, only a handful have continued to raise hell about the fate of the community. Thus, Assemblymember Maxine Waters and Watts Labor Action leader Ted Watkins did pressure the legislature to finally hold hearings on local plant closures and economic distress. No comparable city council initiative was taken. Despite a harrowing accumulation of testimony, the legislature, so keen to succor law enforcement, did nothing to address the economic decline that was obviously fueling crime rates. Bolder action has been advocated by the surviving cadre of Los Angeles's 1960s Black Power movement, particularly Michael Zinzun of the Committee Against Police Abuse and Anthony Thigpen of Jobs with Peace. But their dogged attempts to build precinct-level organization in the community and to develop a grassroots agenda of critical needs have been repeatedly sabotaged by various power structures, including ostensibly liberal Democrats. Thus, the Jobs with Peace campaign for a citywide assessment of the impact of military spending on local communities was countered by a vicious propaganda barrage from the political consultants to the Westside Berman-Waxman-Levine machine. Zinzun's efforts, meanwhile, to expose police brutality led to a savage, unprovoked beating by Pasadena police and the loss of an eye. It is no criticism of the courageous dedication of these inner-city organizers to point out the David and Goliath character of their struggle. Unlike Chicago in 1986, where economic devastation in the ghetto could be laid neatly at the door of white political supremacy, in Los Angeles, the Bradley regime, with its inner circle of Southside ministers and cronies, has been a powerful deterrent to the coalescence of black protest or electoral insurgency. Without the mobilized counterweight of angry protest, South Central LA has been betrayed by virtually every level of government. In particular, the deafening public silence about youth unemployment and the juvenation of poverty has left many thousands of young street people with little alternative but to enlist in the crypto-Keynesian youth employment program operated by the cocaine cartels. Revisiting Watts nearly a generation after a famous pioneering study of its problems, UCLA industrial relations economist Paul Bullock discovered that the worsening conditions described by the Times' Watts 10 Years Later team in 1975 had deteriorated still further, and that endemic unemployment was at the core of the community's despair. Bullock observed that the last rational option open to Watts youth, at least in the neoclassical sense of utility-maximizing economic behavior, was to sell drugs. The political economy of crack. What's right? If you want something, you have the right to take it. If you want to do something, you have the right to do it. Bret Easton Ellis, Less Than Zero. Since the late 1970s, every major sector of the Southern California economy, from tourism to apparel, has restructured around the increasing role of foreign trade and offshore investment. South Central LA, as we have indicated, has been the main loser in this transformation, since Asian imports have closed factories without creating compensatory economic opportunities for local residents. The specific genius of the Crips has been their ability to insert themselves into a leading circuit of international trade. Through crack, they have discovered a vocation for the ghetto in LA's New World City economy. Peddling the imported high-profit rock stuff to a bipolar market of final consumers, including rich West Siders as well as poor street people, the Crips have become as much lumpen capitalists as outlaw proletarians. if this has only underwritten their viciousness with a new competitive imperative, it has added to their charisma the weight of gold-braided neck chains and showy rings. In an age of narco-imperialism, they have become modern analogues to the gunpowder states of West Africa, those selfish rogue chieftaincies who were middlemen in the 18th century slave trade, prospering while the rest of Africa bled. The Latino East Side gangs, by contrast, are still trying to catch up, dealing largely in homegrown drugs like PCP, amphetamines, and marijuana, with relatively low turnover values in a market consisting almost entirely of other poor teenagers. They are unable to accumulate the fineries or weaponry of the Crips. They have yet to effectively join the world market. The contemporary cocaine trade is a stunning example of what some political economists, after the MIT duo of Sable and Pior, are now calling flexible accumulation on a hemispheric scale. The rules of the game are to combine maximum financial control with flexible and interchangeable deployment of producers and sellers across variable national landscapes. At the primary producer end, of course, coca has been the major economic adaptation of the Andean economies to the bank-imposed debt depression of the 1980s. Tens of thousands of peasants have migrated to coke rush frontiers, like the famous Huallaga Valley of Peru, where they increasingly enjoy the protection of the Inca Maoists of Sendero Luminoso against the Green Berets and the Peruvian army. In the late 1980s, the Colombian overlords tried to ensure the continuity of their supply as well as their ability to impose a buyer's price on peasant producers by opening their own auxiliary coca plantations using wage labor. Like oil production, however, the strategic instance is the refining process, centralized in Colombian laboratories under the personal supervision of the Medellin cartel, or its Cali-based rival. In popular imagination, the Medellin cartel has replaced the mafia as the symbol of a super-criminal conspiracy of almost occult power. Indeed, Bush and Bennett often talk as if America is fighting a war of the worlds against extraterrestrial invaders. The reality, of course, has always been more prosaic. Washington wages war on the same invisible hand that it otherwise deifies. As Fortune pointed out a few years back, the Medellin Group have always been distinguished by their business-like mentality and their success in turning cocaine trafficking into a well-managed multinational industry. Eric Hobsbawm, an aficionado of bandits and imperialists, made the same point several years ago in a review. Left to themselves in the principles of Adam Smith, the consortia of Medellin investors would no more see themselves as criminals than did the Dutch or English venturers into the Indies trade, including opium, who organized their speculative cargoes in much the same way. The trade rightly resents being called a mafia. It is basically an ordinary business that has been criminalized, as Colombians see it, by a U.S. which cannot manage its own affairs. Like any ordinary business, in an initial sales boom, the cocaine trade had to contend with changing relations of supply and demand. Overproduction, due both to the cartel's deliberate promotion of supply and to the peasants' desperate stampede toward a saleable staple, has been endemic since the mid-1980s. Despite the monopsonistic position of the cartels vis-a-vis the producers, the wholesale price of cocaine fell by half. This, in turn, dictated a transformation in sales strategy and market structure. The result was a switch from haute cuisine to fast food, as the Medellin cartel, starting in 1981 or 1983, accounts differ, designated Los Angeles as a proving ground for the mass sales potential of rock cocaine, or crack. Shortly before its demise in 1989, the Herald Examiner published a sensationalized overview of Cartel LA that synthesized law enforcement viewpoints on the history and organization of the crack economy. According to this account, the Colombian cartels responded to the militarization of federal drug enforcement in South Florida after 1982 by rerouting cocaine through Mexico with the aid of the Guadalajara Mafia, run by Miguel Gallardo, the godfather presumed to have ordered the torture murder of DEA agent Kiki Camarena in 1985. Upon its arrival in Southern California via couriers or light aircraft, The Drug Enforcement Authority claims there are over 100 clandestine airstrips in the California desert. The cocaine, by 1988 estimated to total 450,000 pounds annually, is supposedly warehoused and processed for wholesale distribution by Colombian nationals bound to the cartels by unbreakable omerta. Originally estimated to number a few hundred, the Colombians, in 1989, suddenly became an invading army, thousands strong, organized into as many as 1,000 cells. An IRS official described cell workers as soldiers coming into this country who are doing their tours of duty and then getting out. Alarmed by news of the invasion, nervous Southern California residents were put on the lookout for suspicious Latin Americans, especially polite, well-dressed families, or individuals with penchants for quiet suburban neighborhoods. In any event, the financial turnover in LA's rock and powder markets appears easier to estimate than the number of cartel foot soldiers. Los Angeles has been described by the Justice Department as an ocean of drug-tainted cash. Between 1985 and 1987, the real takeoff years for crack, the cash surplus in the Los Angeles branch of the Federal Reserve System increased 2,300% to $3.8 billion, a sure index, according to federal experts, of the volume of illicit coke dollars. In early 1989, a small army of feds overwhelmed downtown LA's jewelry mart in Operation Polar Cap, a spectacular attack on La Mina, the gold mine, a $1 billion per year money laundering operation supposedly run on behalf of the Medellin cartel by several dozen immigrant Armenian gold dealers. The disclosure of La Mina seemed to confirm earlier assertions by U.S. Attorney, now Federal Judge Robert Bonner, that L.A. had surpassed Miami as the principal distribution center for the nation's cocaine supply, a claim that the Justice Department officially recognized in August 1989. The vast three-volume Dun & Bradstreet primer on the pervasiveness of drugs in America that Attorney General Thornburg presented that month to drug czar William Bennett also proclaimed that L.A. drug gangs were firmly allied with the Medellin cartel in a plot to flood American inner cities with crack. Quoting copiously from LAPD sources, the report pictured L.A. overrun by Colombians and the USA overrun by their Crip henchmen. Los Angeles street gangs now dominate the rock cocaine trade in Los Angeles and elsewhere, due in part to their steady recourse to murderous violence to enforce territorial dealing supremacy, to deter cheating and to punish rival gang members. The LAPD has identified 47 cities, from Seattle to Kansas City to Baltimore, where Los Angeles street gang traffickers have appeared. Washington's official adoption of the LAPD's characterization of LA street gangs as highly organized mafias in cahoots with the Colombians, a view also embraced by the California Attorney General's office, was challenged by two USC professors who had been carefully analyzing arrest records of crack dealers over the previous 2 years. In studying 741 cases in five gang-infested sections of Los Angeles County, they discovered that only 25% of the alleged dealers were active gang members. Although acknowledging that the direct role of gangs might have substantially increased since their 1984-5 data, the USC team stood by their principal conclusions. The explosion in cocaine sales was engaging a number of street gang members, but was in no way dominated by gang involvement. The drug parameters simply overwhelmed the gang parameters. The cohesiveness of the gangs themselves is very low. To expect a group like that to take on mafia characteristics seems very unlikely. Responding to this study, the LAPD's gang drug czar Deputy Chief Glenn Levant admitted that 64% of the 7,000 suspected dealers arrested through his gang-related active trafficker program were not identifiable as gang members. But he denied that the department had overstated the problem, since 36% gang membership is very significant, and many, if not a majority, of the other arrestees were older ex-gang members. But Levant's revision of the USC study, that is, a more significant direct participation of gang members and a large, if not dominant, role played by adult OGs, still seemingly leaves in place the USC team's key finding that the gang role in drug distribution is too incoherent to qualify for the organized crime network badge that Levant's boss, Chief Gates, and most other law enforcement officials want to pin on the Crips and Bloods. All of which is to say that the South Central gangs are definitely in the drug business, but as small businessmen, not crime corporations, and usually under the supervision of older dealers who in turn answer to a shadowy wholesale hierarchy of middlemen and cartel representatives. On the other hand, the very diffuseness of a crack trade organized through hundreds of competing gang sets and small-time dealers, while it belies the demonic power that the gangbusters would attribute to it, also defies all efforts to deliver the decisive knockout blow. In the ghetto itself, there are hundreds of independent rock house franchises, each turning over, according to LAPD estimates, about $5,000 per day, $25,000 on welfare and Social Security check days. The constant attrition of such outlets to LAPD raids, like the one Nancy Reagan used as a media picnic, has become an ordinary business cost. Moreover, if Levant's estimate of 10,000 gang members making their livelihood from the drug trade is anywhere near correct, then crack really is the employer of last resort in the ghetto's devastated east side, the equivalent of several large auto plants or several hundred McDonald's. Of course, this is reindustrialization through disease and the redistribution of poverty. When $25 rock hit the streets of LA in volume during 1984-5, hospital and police statistics register the cataclysmic impact, doubling of emergency room admissions for cocaine trauma, 15% of newborns in public hospitals diagnosed drug-addicted, quintupling of juvenile arrests for coke dealing, and so on. It is important to remember that crack is not simply cheap cocaine, the poor man's version of the glamour drug stuffed up the noses of the marina and country club crowd, but a far more lethal form. Whether or not it is actually the most addictive substance known to science, as originally claimed, it remains an absolute commodity enslaving its consumers. The most devastating of all the monster drugs to afflict any American adolescent generation thus far. For this epidemic bred out of despair, which like heroin inevitably turns users into petty dealers, the only treatment on demand is jail. In Los Angeles County, where infant mortality is soaring and the county trauma treatment network has collapsed, it is not surprising that medical care for crack addiction, which experts agree requires long-term treatment in a therapeutic community, is generally unavailable. Thus, Skid Row, downtown's nightmarish nickel, has the largest single concentration of crack addicts, young and old, in the city, but not a single treatment facility. Wealthy Pasadena is fighting crack-based gang activity in its northwest ghetto with its own version of the hammer, including humiliating strip searches in the field and a drug tenant eviction policy, without spending a single cent on drug rehabilitation. The examples could be depressingly multiplied as drug treatment is filed in the same bottom drawer of forgotten liberal nostrums as youth employment or gang counseling. In the meantime, gang members have become the stoic philosophers of this cold new reality. The appearance of crack has given the Crip subculture a terrible, almost irresistible allure. Which is not simply to reduce the gang phenomenon, now or in the past, to mere economic determinism. Since the 1840s, when tough young Irishmen invented the modern street gang in the slums of the Bowery, Five Points, and Paradise Alley, making the Bowery Boys and the Dead Rabbits just as dreaded as the Crips and Bloods are today, gang bonding has been a family for the forgotten, a total solidarity, like national or religious fervor, closing out other empathies and transmuting self-hatred into tribal rage. But the Crips and Bloods, decked out in Gucci t-shirts and expensive Nike Air shoes, ogling rock dealers driving by in BMWs, are also authentic creatures of the age of Reagan. Their worldview, above all, is formed of an acute awareness of what is going down on the West Side, where gilded youth practice the insolent indifference and avarice that are also forms of street violence. Across the spectrum of runaway youth consumerism and the impossible fantasies of personal potency and immunity, youth of all classes and colors are grasping at undeferred gratification, even if it paves the way to assured self-destruction. There is little reason to believe that the crack economy or the new gang culture will stop growing, whatever the scale of repression, or stay confined to South Central Los Angeles. Although the epicenters remain in the ghetto zones of hardcore youth unemployment, like Watts Willowbrook, the Athens district, or the Escher-like maze of the Crenshaw jungle, the gang mystique has spread, as Bakir documents in Crips, into middle-class black areas where parents are close to panic or vigilantism. Meanwhile, as South Central itself undergoes an epical and surprisingly peaceful ethnic transition from black to new immigrant Latino, Mexican, and Central American, the kids of the Mojados look jealously at the power and notoriety of Cryptum. In the absence of any movement towards social justice, the most explosive social contradiction in Los Angeles may become the blocked mobility of these children of the new immigrants. As a 1989 UCLA study revealed, poverty is increasing faster amongst Los Angeles Latinos, especially youth, than any other urban group in the United States. While their parents may still measure the quality of life by old country standards, the iron rations of Tijuana or Ciudad Guatemala, their children's self-image is shaped by the incessant stimuli of LA consumer culture. Trapped in dead-end, low-wage employment, amid what must otherwise appear as a demi-paradise for white youth, they too are looking for shortcuts and magical paths to personal empowerment. Thus, they also enter the underground economy with guns blazing. Some of the black gangs, especially the East Side Crips, have accommodated the aspirations of the new immigrants by integrating Latino members. The police estimate at least 1,000 of these, or licensing crack-dealing franchises. In the MacArthur Park area, on the other hand, the upstart Salvadorians of Mara Salvatrucha have had to fight a bloody war against the established power of the 18th Street Gang, the largest and fastest-growing Chicano gang which threatens to become the Crips of East L.A. But simultaneously, in East L.A. and throughout all the barrios, old and new, traditional gang topography is being radically redrawn by the emergence of a myriad of micro-gangs, more interested in drug sales territories than neighborhood turf in the old-fashioned sense. Aside from the 230 black and Latino gangs which the LAPD have identified in the Los Angeles area, there are also 81 Asian gangs, and their numbers are also rapidly growing. In Long Beach, gangs of wild, parentless Cambodian boat children terrorize their elders and steal their hoarded gold. While the Filipino Satanas favor Chicano gang styles, the role model of the Viet Crips, supposedly robbery specialists, is obvious. In Pasadena, some Chinese high school dropouts, unwilling to spend lifetimes as busboys and cooks, ambushed and killed a carload of crack DEA agents before they too were cut down by a vengeful posse of nearly 100 cops. These particular contradictions are rising fast along a curve asymptotic with the mean ethos of the age. In a post-liberal society, with the gang planks pulled up and compassion strictly rationed by the federal deficit and the Jarvis Amendment, where a lynch mob demagogue like William Bennett reigns as drug czar, is it any wonder that poor youths are hallucinating on their own desperado power trips? In Los Angeles, there are too many signs of approaching helter-skelter. Everywhere in the inner city, even in the forgotten poor white boondocks with their zombie populations of speed freaks, gangs are multiplying at a terrifying rate, cops are becoming more arrogant and trigger-happy, and a whole generation is being shunted towards some impossible Armageddon.